morning. Good morning.
It is so good to be back here. It's really exciting for us to come. We have we moved away about 8 years ago, and coming back here today just feels like we've slipped right back in. And that is a true testament to the warmth and the openness of this church and this community, and we appreciate it. We can't say that enough. You know, it's we came back to be, for Lucretia to be a part of kicking off this series. Personally, I came back for a few days of free childcare.
Yep.
You know, I don't know. We've got three children, and childcare is expensive. I can't tell you how many times we've gone out. Well, let's go. We're going to go to a dinner. We're going to go to the movies. We're going to go do this. And we get back, and the childcare costs more than the time out. That just bothers me. I don't know what it is. There's something inside of me that just, I can't settle with that.
That's what you get for having three children.
That's what I, it's your fault
it's your
that we
fault.
Have three kids.
I think it's your fault.
So. But we're really excited about being here. You know, Brownicity, that what we're talking a little bit about today and kicking off here, you know, Lucretia and I have known each other a very long time. We met in 1996. It only took me 5 years to get my first date, but it only took me 8 months after that to marry her. So
smart guy.
Yeah, she was. I used to tell my friends that if I ever get a shot with her, we're closing the deal. You know, so
that's
what we did. That's what we did. But since then, since we have known each other in 1996 together, we have been a part of multiple churches that have had a desire, been in the process, or wanting to make their church congregation more diverse. Wanted to open their doors to people who are not naturally attracted to their congregation. And we've been a part of black churches who have tried to diversify. We've been a part of white churches who have been a part who have had a desire to diversify. And we've seen a lot of different things over the last 20 years. And it's really brought us to this place 20 years later where Lucretia published the book. And so we're really excited about that. The book is doing incredibly well. It's getting a lot of attention across the country. We're on the second edition of it. And so we're really excited. But today we're going to have a little conversation. And I just want to start the conversation off that, you know, we've been doing this for so long,
mm-hmm.
And then you write the book. Why did you write the book now? What took 20 years to write the book?
Well, actually, so writing the book, this book, it was kind of an accident. Like, I didn't set out to write a book and like publish. It's really like a curriculum guide and a journal. And like I said, I didn't try to do that on purpose. Like Nathan said, you know, we've kind of been living this life of being very intentional about eradicating racial division in our lives. Any of our friends, anyone, if you've ever spent time with us, you know that that's something that we're passionate about, and we live it out in our lives any way we can and the best way we know how. And so a lot of times in the past, people would say to us, you guys should do something with this. Like, you should take this conversation, you know, beyond your house or beyond the table, you know, at your house. And I'm thinking, well, who in the world wants to talk about, you know, race? Like, I don't think that'd be interesting. And then about 2014, Holy Spirit really started to work on me and work in me about race, and kept saying things like, I want your healed voice out there, and I want you to commit to racial healing. And I'm kind of like, what? I don't even really know what that is exactly. Or what do you mean, my healed voice? And so just kind of taking me through this whole process and conversation, kind of going back and forth. So initially, as the Holy Spirit was saying to do this and to have these conversations and to take this conversation beyond our home, and it should be a platform, unlike this beautiful song that we just sang about saying yes, I said absolutely no. Absolutely not. I will not do that. It was something that seemed really scary for me outside of my home, because race is a taboo topic. There's a lot of fear attached to it. And honestly, people are really bad at it. Like, people are really bad at having the conversation in a very life-giving and hopeful way. And I'm like, I don't want to be a part of that at all. So, no thank you. But eventually, I kind of gave in. God is so sweet and kind of directed me in a really sweet and gentle way, which is, you know, how we came with Brownicity and really helping families grow the capacity to equip young people, to equip their children to even grow up and to be a part of the world change that is necessary. But about 2015, is that right? Yep, 2015, June 14th. I was in church. It was a Sunday. I was in church, and fortunately, I was in the back, and the music was really loud because I suddenly was overcome with a heaviness and a burden, like a spiritual heaviness, a spiritual burden, and I was doubled over, crying and yelling, and again, the music was really loud, so nobody noticed that I was kind of going through this thing. And then I had a vision as I was crying and yelling and praying, and it was of these arms that were chained together. And I saw the arms were chained together, and I understood that was the church, that it represented the church. And the church had been enslaved into this, like, passivity, being passive and kind of stuck, that's a good word, stuck regarding addressing social and racial injustice. So I knew that that's what that was about, and so I continued to cry and travail until I saw the chains break and I saw the arms rise up in victory. And again, like, I didn't know what to do with that. Even that day, as I was crying and doubled over, I walked over to the prayer people, you know, who were supposed to help, and they didn't even know what to do with that. I'm trying to tell them about this vision, and they're like, okay, baby, yeah, we do, all right. See, so nobody knows what to do with this. So I'm like, okay. So I, you know, go back to my seat. But I knew in that instance, and I knew what was being communicated, and that was, it's time. Like, it's time. It's time for you to do something. You know, me specifically and us collectively. So this no more saying, you know, no, or no more kind of taking my time. And so that was a Sunday, June 14th, 2015. And then 3 days later, on a Wednesday, June 17th, 2015, was when the Charleston massacre happened. A shooter walked into an AME Zion church in Charleston, South Carolina, and started shooting amidst 10 worshipers and killed 9 of them. And I understood that the vision that I had and the travailing and the crying was connected to that event. And what happened in churches all over the country, especially in the South, you know, and Charleston is significant there. So what happened is then that the church began to collectively wake up and stir and be irritated and aggravated about what was going on. Wait, we thought we were colorblind. We thought we're living in a post-racial society. We thought, like, if you just love everybody, then everything is okay. But that event set off this, the understanding that, no, everything is not okay, and, you know, we've kind of been asleep at the wheel, and there's some things that we need to do collectively as a body to move our nation to the place that it needs to be. So in the church that we are in Charlotte, North Carolina, they came to us and said, okay, I need you to do something. Like, we don't know what, but we need to move forward differently than the way. And it's a multi-ethnic church, and people, you know, say, oh, well, we love everybody, and everybody loves everybody. But that doesn't stop injustices from taking place. And so they wanted to move forward differently. They wanted to understand. I was just blown away because, again, I had been telling God, no, nobody's going to want to have this conversation, and no, I don't want to do this. And then here people are coming to me saying, okay, you, like, they identified me specifically. It wasn't like they shopped around. They came to me specifically, said, hey, you know, I want, oh, could you please put something together for us to learn? And even before that, I skipped a part. Even before that, I had gone to an event where I didn't know anyone. It was a worship event, and this was before the Charleston incident, where a perfect stranger, I didn't know her, she didn't know me, she walked up to me, she said, you know, can I talk to you? Can I share something with you? And, you know, initially I'm thinking, no, because I don't know you. But she was holding a baby, so I thought she might be safe. So I said, okay, sure. And she started to talk to me about how God wanted to use me for racial healing. And she went on and on, and I'm standing there like, yeah, I know, I've heard this before. Yeah, I've heard this before. So even that had happened. That had happened, and now the massacre had happened, and then people were saying, okay, need you to take us forward differently. So then that's how I put together a curriculum and a process. So not just information, but a process that kind of even mirrored my own transformation, and the work that Holy Spirit did in me. So it's a very guided study, to take people from, you know, to get people a good beginning and an on-ramp. And so we started kind of hosting this class or facilitating the class, and then I developed a handout because I knew people needed some introspection, not just information, but they needed introspection and reflection to help foster growth within. And then the handout actually just turned into this right here. So kind of accidentally became this book that I published.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things that I thought was interesting is that when you go back to that event in Charleston, some of the verbiage that was used during that event where the shooter had said, I want to start a race war,
mm-hmm.
right? And so there's something very significant about the fact that he went to a church to do that. Right, it was a Wednesday night Bible study. We've all been to a, if you grew up in church, you've been to a Wednesday night Bible study, right? There were 10 people there that night. When's the last time you went to the grocery store and there was only 10 people there? You know, when's the last time you went to a shopping mall and there were only 10 people there? So it wasn't about the number of people that were there, but it was about the very specific location in which he went. So it was really, really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
We have gotten a lot of feedback from the book, and I want to read a couple of them. We have some pictures of the folks who have taken the course, who have read the books, and here's a couple things they said. Vicky Maria says, I took the class last year, and it was the catalyst of much racial healing in my life. Led by Dr. Lucretia Carter Berry from Brownicity, I recommend this class for anyone interested in understanding the history of race and the impact that it has had in our country. Included is her book, What Lies Between Us, which will guide you through self-reflection and your journey to racial healing.
And yeah, I want to say something about Vicky. Vicky is actually multi-ethnic. She's African-American and Latina, and she's married to an African-American man, and she has two young children. And so even her experience going through the class would be different than yours or mine. But she talks about often and how she experienced just healing within herself and her own, you know, personal identity as a multi-ethnic person, that she'd never had access to this type of healing before in her life. And so she has just embraced Brownicity. Now she's on our team, and now she's leading her own charges. She's a homeschool mom, and now she's even reshaping curriculum to reflect what I should say we need to learn in order to be able to overcome some of the things we need to.
Tiffany Trudwin wrote, last year I took this course and it became the changing point for me toward racial relations. A very family-friendly course, this five-week study is a great step to finding out more about our racial history and what we need to do now. Join Dr. Lucretia Carter Berry, the author of this study, as we discover and discuss race in a grace-filled space with understanding and healing as the ultimate goals.
Yeah, can I say something about
it?
And Tiffany, her story is cool because here she is, you know, white family and with a beautiful heart and wanting to do her best and trying to raise children who are conscious and conscientious, and again will be a part of this shifting and changing that needs to occur. And so I had put an article out there about, you know, how colorblindness doesn't solve the problem. It actually contributes to the problem. And she just got so upset because she thought she had been telling her children, you know, the right thing to do. And so she came to me and she had so many questions. And she was really committed to learning, you know, what are the right things she should be telling her children and what should she be doing. And so from that, I actually wrote an article. It was really because of her, because of all her questions. And I wrote an article, and that article was published. But it's just also great to see, yes, families who, I mean, if you just look at them, you know, you might go, well, why are they interested in this conversation? But God is pulling on and tugging on people's hearts, and Holy Spirit is stirring, and people are wanting to know, regardless of what you look like, regardless of whether you are being crushed by the system or you're being benefited by systems of injustice, people want to know what steps to take and what to do. And so Tiffany and her family is another example of a family who started out clueless and have come on board, and they've learned so much. And now I feel like a lot of these people are dragging me along now because they're excited about what they've learned, and they want to be a part of world change.
So there's a couple phrases in these in these quotes here that I want to pull out. Self-reflection,
mm-hmm.
Journey, grace-filled space.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about what those words mean and how they inform the process.
Right. So, it isn't just like some information. It's actually a thin book, as you can tell. So if it was just history, I mean, it's leaving a lot of stuff out. It's a guide. It's a guide, and the process is intentional. So we've been doing this for a long time. So we've been a part of a lot of workshops, seminars, conversations, dialogue, discussions, and we've seen it done poorly a lot, actually poorly a lot more than not. And so we kind of drew from this experience of, okay, of what to not do, and then what is it that, you know, when our friends were saying, we really like having this conversation with you, you know, what is it that they like? And so we made that a part of this process. So, for example, one of the things we have is vocabulary words, you know, because this is a class, it's like school, so you have to have vocabulary words, because a lot of times the conversation goes awry because people don't have a common understanding of certain terms. So, for example, do you know the difference between race, culture, ethnicity, and nationality? Most people do not. Most people clump all that into one identity or one qualifier. And so when you're trying to maybe have a conversation about race, or you're trying to have a conversation about maybe culture or nationality, then, you know, people, the conversation can't be very productive. You don't get very far. Like I remember one guy, he said, when we were talking about being all hues of brown, and we're all hues of brown because of melanin, he goes, well, I'm I can't be a hue of brown because I'm white. And he said, and I'm Italian. And so it's like, if I take on this identity of Christ, does that mean I can't make spaghetti anymore? I don't know, something ridiculous like that. But you see, so
racist.
Right. Or something. Well, he said it. But you see, so he was equating race to ethnicity to skin tone, all very different things. And so I would like to say that, yes, he's come quite a far on his journey as well. But also, people don't know the distinction between, like, systemic racism and interpersonal racism. So especially, like, in churches, we'll say, oh, we love everybody. And we love everybody. Yes, we do. And that's great. But does me loving you, does that help or does that hinder or disrupt systemic racism? No, it does not. And so oftentimes you could be having a conversation, like, typically when I'm talking about race and racism, I'm talking about systemic, which can also be broken down into institutional and structural. Mm-hmm. See? So, and then someone else is saying, but I just love everybody. So what? And I'm like, okay, but that's not what we're talking about. Like, good for you. But still, you see? So we learn a common language. We learn the benefit of becoming listeners and learners. I find a lot with this conversation that people want to talk a lot. When it comes to race, people want to talk a lot. And I've come to understand the less that people know, the more they want to talk. And they want to share their opinions. But we need to take a break from that. And learn and get some knowledge and get some understanding. So I have a process in place for that. And some people don't like it in terms of, okay, let's be quiet and learn. And let's learn for a few weeks before we start to talk. Let's learn. And then why don't you journal and reflect in your journal, because you need a reflective process. The way that the brain works is if you get information that is foreign to you, if you have cognitive dissonance, and your brain will reject it, even if it's the truth. If you've been lying to your whole life about who you are and somebody tells you the truth, you're going to be like, no way, because I haven't been told this. You see, so that's why we factor in a process of reflecting. I base this off of Dr. Caroline Leaf's book about, it's called Who Switched Off My Brain, and it's this. She has this whole model of reflection and walking you through some things that help you actually change your brain. And she says, we are all neuroplasticians. So as humans, we have the ability to actually change our brains. Like, we can actually think about how we think. And we can do certain things to shift our thinking and change our beliefs. When we change our beliefs, that changes the structure of our brain, and then we act differently. Imagine that. But we need that part in this process. You need introspection. If not, you just have information. So it's like, okay, in 19 such and such and such and such, and 17 such and such and such and such, and then you just move on about your way. No, this is a process that helps you be transformed from the inside out. And so it's even based out of or inspired by Romans 12:2 that says, and do not be conformed to this world, because our world is this environment that we breathe in. So it does inform our identity if we don't, if we're not consciously addressing that. So it says, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. And so this is to help foster an inward transformation, because only when we're transformed inwardly, then can we begin to actually transform our communities outside of us. Otherwise, we're just reacting. We're just reacting to what's already happening in the world or what has been handed down. Like, you know, you have to ask yourself, am I actually transforming? Am I actually creating as God does, creating something that is necessary and new? Or am I just responding to what the generation before me created or what the generation before them created? So this is designed to foster that type of development and to grow the capacity for people to be able to engage on that level.
Cool. Mm-hmm. I want to read a different translation of Romans 12:2. It says, do not allow this world to mold you in its own image. Instead, be transformed from the inside out by renewing your mind. As a result, you will be able to discern what God wills, and whatever God finds good, pleasing, and complete. Talk about what that scripture means to you.
Well, I just see it as this opportunity to be really a disruptive force in kind of the status quo of the world. The world is this, you know, collection of, you know, power and policies and politics and a social structure and but I have the choice to either conform to that and conform to what the outside world is telling me to be and telling me to become, or from the inside I can be transformed and I can be a different force in the world. Then it just makes me think about last summer, I started reading my family history. And with a lot of African Americans, that's kind of unique, that you would be able to trace and know your family history all the way back to enslaved Africans. And even in this case, a family historian has traced the African who came over on the slave ship and what country and city in Africa that my ancestor came from. And so, yeah, it's fascinating. Like, I'm reading it, I'm intrigued, and so, ironically, I think this is a very unique experience that my ancestor and my ancestors had as they were brought to actually Winston-Salem, or to Salem, North Carolina, which is where I'm from, actually, so we didn't migrate far. Still there. And our ancestors weren't owned by, like, these wealthy aristocrats or plantation owners, actually. My family was actually owned by the Moravian Church. Yeah, exactly. The church, yes, the church. So the Moravians, who prided themselves, or, you know, they prized themselves on being so different, peace-loving people and a different community, actually at a particular point, with some pressure from some of the business owners in the church, one in particular, the Fry family, owned these big mills, and so they pressured the church, and they wanted to be able to keep up with the economic competition, or whatever the economic climate was at that time. And so then they pressured the church to then be able to own slaves. So initially the church said, well, no, we don't want our individual people to own slaves, because that will make you lazy. You need to do your own work, right? But then they said, we'll own the slaves. So the actual church owned the slaves, and the people rented them out. And then after that, after more pressure, then eventually that the Fry family was able to own some slaves. And I just think back on that, like, what if you would not have conformed to, what if the church had not conformed to that climate? And what has happened as a result of that church conforming to the social, political, economic climate at that time? Like, what would have been so wrong with doing things differently? I'm pretty sure that there were options. And so even the historian to this day says he will not step foot into a church that is led by a white person, because of the sense that, you know, during the time of segregation, the Southern church or the Southern white church was really the bastion for segregation. So to keep kind of the status quo of the political and economic climate that was at that time. And I just think back, you know, like, what if they would have done things differently? This historian says the church didn't speak up. The church didn't speak up. And that just shook me. What if the church spoke up? What if the church spoke up? What if the church actually, like, did the kind of stuff that Jesus did? Yeah, what if? So that's what Romans 12:2. When I think about that, that's what that means to me. What about you, Romans?
You know, this one's an interesting one for me, because when I was growing up, this whole, you know, don't be conformed to the world concept meant, you know, the clothes that I wore, you know, or the music that I listened to, or the TV shows that I watched. You know, I was a kid growing up, you're not allowed to listen to the radio, you know, only cassette tapes, and only Christian cassette tapes, and, you know, I didn't get to watch the Smurfs until I went to college, you know, and then, of course, I binge-watched the Smurfs my freshman year of college, which may have something to do with how well I did or did not do that first year. But that's what it was about for me. I think it's evolved for me and opened up for me, in a sense, to more of this overarching message that we get from our culture, and the way that the message that we get from the system that is our country and our state. And I think, and it translates to even other countries and other states to not be conformed to these systems, because our systems were built in a way to give particular opportunity and to give particular access to a very certain group of people, people that look like me. Right? And so this scripture now means to me not to be conformed to that system, because it's so natural for me and it just comes without effort for me to slip into the system that is designed for me. And so for me, what it means to not be conformed to the world, but to have my mind transformed, or to be transformed by the renewing of my mind, is to never allow myself to not be aware of the privileges that I receive in our society because of the color of my skin. And it takes our effort, it takes intentional effort to speak out against this lack of opportunity and this lack of access that we do not all experience and we do not all benefit from. You know, it was really interesting to me when I was graduating from seminary a few years ago. We were all looking for jobs and everything. And I remember one of my friends who was interviewing for a senior pastor position in another state. And he was interviewing before this panel of people from the church. And they were looking to hire a new person. And he said to them, he said, before we get started, if there is a woman or a person of color who has equal credentials to me, my advice to you is to give them the position. And I thought that was such a powerful thing to say for a person who has grown up in a place where you've always had opportunity, where you've always had access, to allow someone who has not always experienced that same access and that same opportunity, the opportunity to have that position. Equal credentials, equal education, equal qualifications for the job, to give that, because it's so easy for us, especially imagine someone interviewing for the pastor of a church and the church's congregation is all white. Imagine who they're going to hire. And to push that congregation to say, if there's someone else, hire them. You know, I think about it in terms of my kids are all in school now, and you know, they even go to a small school, right, where there are a limited number of seats in that classroom. And each seat in that classroom represents opportunity, represents access to resources that another child is not getting because there are a limited number of seats. Right? And so when we begin to think about that, there's an what it means to me to truly be transformed is to deny myself opportunity so that someone else can have that opportunity. To put myself behind and put someone else before me. And so when I think about what it means to not be conformed to the world, is to not be conformed to the systems that run our culture and the opportunity that's given to some that's not given to others.
Yeah, that's hard. That's hard.
Let me ask you this question. How can the church, both corporately and individually, be active in these conversations?
Well, just really quickly, you know, we can just think about it this way. As individuals and corporately, Christ never sounded or looked like the political, social, and religious power at that time. That's why, you know, he was crucified, because he upset the system. And so just, you know, we have this opportunity to walk in that fully and to actually redeem the oneness that he prayed about, because, you know, he prayed about it, and then we didn't mention that this time about the church in Acts.
Mm-hmm.
That was, they were already functioning in this oneness, this once a group of people divided into 18 different ethnic groups and had nothing, you know, in common. They, you know, just blew away their community when they all came together with only the gospel in common. So you see, we have been one before. We just currently, you know, live in the lie of division and segregation. And so now we need to redeem the oneness that Jesus prayed for. And in that, we gain our credibility as a witness, and we gain, we shine this brighter light. So individually, we have to be about doing the work within us that's necessary, and asking the hard questions and doing the hard work. And then collectively, the same. And a lot of times, you know, it's uncomfortable, and you know, you find yourself, your identity being turned inside out and upside down. But when you think about it, I mean, that's the kingdom we belong to. We belong to this upside down, inside out, quote unquote, backwards kingdom. And so we just need to take our steps personally and collectively towards, like, disrupting the culture that divides us and segregates us. So, yeah. Oh, then I ask you a question now. Okay, so now a lot of times I hear this in churches or in the faith kind of culture. Aren't these conversations a distraction, like race? Shouldn't we just leave that up to the liberals? Isn't that just a social issue? Shouldn't we just stick to the gospel? What do you say about that?
Yeah, I would say that that you can't separate the two. You can never separate the gospel from the other. We heard this morning, you know, the commandment is to love God with all your heart and to love your neighbor as yourself. You know, the gospel is incomplete if you're living your life under the auspice that I love God with all my heart. That's impossible to do without also loving your neighbor. And so this idea that we can live isolated with just me and God, you know, Jesus take the wheel, you know, that sort of thing, you know, like, is leaving out a whole half of what the gospel is. And, you know, it makes me think about the story of Jesus and the woman at the well. And without getting into all of the intricacies of that story, the woman at the well represented the ultimate other from Jesus.
Yep.
She was the ultimate other, someone he would not traditionally have been allowed to speak to because of how different they were.
That's right.
And so we have to always have in our hearts, always have in our minds, the other. And that is the true gospel.
It is.
The true gospel is not, you know, me in this isolationist world of just me and God. It's me and the other, those in my community and those who are outside of my community as well.
That's right. That's good. Okay, and so, yeah, you've been doing this, again, for a long time. So what advice do you have for maybe people who are just at the beginning, or maybe they're moving along in their journey? What advice do you have for them?
Yeah, I would say, you know, as you mentioned earlier, you know, when you take a class, when you start a class, you know, you don't come in with all the answers. Right, you come in ready to listen, you know, ready to learn, and ready to grow. You know, we've all been in a classroom where when the teacher asks a question, the same person raises their hand to give all the answers. Right? At first it's a little bit annoying, but then by the end of the class, nobody likes that person because they seem to have all the answers, you know? And then it becomes about how wrong that person is. The reality of it is, for me, is that, yes, we've been doing this for 20 years. Together, we've been married 15 years with 3 children, and there's no one on this planet that I'm closer to than you. And the reality of it is, before you clap too much, the reality of it is that I have racist tendencies. I have racist tendencies inside of me.
we should always be leery of the person who says, I'm the least racist person you'll ever meet.
I got a black friend.
Yeah, I got a black friend. You know,
like, I'm not racist. Not a racist bone in my body.
Right, exactly. Because it might not be on the surface, but it's always under there. No matter how long we've been doing this, no matter what it means to us, it is always under there because it's a part of our culture. It's a part of where we come from. And we have to be willing to recognize in the heat of the moment. You know, when it comes up for me is when I become uncomfortable. You know, when it comes up for me, when I get in a situation where my opportunity, my privilege is being attacked. You know, it's easy for me when I'm just kind of going along life or I'm, you know, talking to some friends and, you know, and I don't say a racist joke or I don't laugh at a racist joke or I even call somebody out on something. That part is easy for me. But it's when I don't have the opportunity that I've become accustomed to that it rears up for me. One quick story is that when I went to seminary, I was my grade point average, you know, too much Smurfs in undergrad. My grade point average wasn't quite enough. In fact, it was 0.05 below the level to get into graduate school. And so they said, because of your experience, we're going to let you in, but we will not allow you any federal funding. We will not allow you to get a school loan, right? Then I knew other students in my class, who were not white, who had a lower grade point average and got full ride scholarships. And suddenly I had a problem. Right?
And
it wasn't Smurfs anymore. Yeah. Suddenly I had a problem and it took me a while to really reconcile with this, you know, about opportunity. Who's grown up with opportunity? Mm-hmm. Who's grown up with access to resources and who has not? Mm-hmm. You know, and it was not necessarily about everyone being equal, but it was about everyone receiving the same equity. It was about everyone receiving an opportunity to have a seat at the table. And so I still have these times, I still have these moments where, you know, having a black wife doesn't give me off the hook. You know what I'm saying? You know, I can't pull out my black card because I got one in my pocket, just in case anybody wants to know. Isn't enough, you know? I still have to deal with my own internal stuff, right? And so that's what I would say. You know, for a person who's beginning on your journey, this is a journey. It's not a take a class and you're going to have all the answers. It's not going to get a friend and all of a sudden you're not racist anymore. You know, and it's not this thing that you accomplish, this box that you check, this goal that you meet. It's a constant, never-ending journey. So come into it with an open heart, come into it with an open mind and open ears, be ready to listen, be ready to learn, and be ready to grow. As we end here, one of the things that we do in all of our courses is a benediction. It's an old school church word. Anybody who grew up in church, you know that we wait for the benediction, right? Our benediction is, and I would like to offer that to us this morning, as we finish, is may we be people of peace with voices of hope doing the hard work of love. So there's still room in the course tonight. It starts tonight. There's over 200 people. It's going to be a ton of people. It's going to be amazing. But there's still space for you. There's space at the table for you. And so please sign up. If you haven't already in the lobby, you can sign up. Thank you very much. We're really excited about the journey that you are on.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much.